Okay.
Thank you for standing by. I would like to remind all participants that today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect at this time.
Okay. Welcome, everybody. This is Ray Fassett. We do a quick roll call.
Absolutely, Ray. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone. On today's call, we have Ray Fassett, Avery Doria, Ron Androff, Wolf Ulrich Knoben. From staff, we have Ken Bauer, Julie Headland, Glenn de Saint-Géry, and myself, Gisela Gruber-White. No apologies noted today, and if I could just remind everyone to state their names for transcript purposes. Thank you. Over to you, Ray.
Thank you very much. We're going to pick up first. I did not send out an agenda for this meeting, which I apologize. But I think we all know we're working on the issue of abstentions as this relates to voting at the council level, given the issue of a potential conflict of interest, and then how does that affect the voting process in terms of changing the denominator. In our last meeting, we had two invited guests, Christina Rosette and Steve Metallitz, who voiced a long-standing concern, really, in as part of the GNSO council voting processes, of sometimes finding themselves in a position of a conflict of interest where they have to abstain, and in effect, that means in tallying the votes, it in effect means a no vote. So they've had this long-standing concern. So as our review and updating of the rules of procedures, this issue was again brought out to potentially for us to look at, try to resolve in some capacity, or at least address the issue, which we've all agreed is reasonable for us to do. So they were on the last call. They again expressed the issue. We tossed back, I think, as a work team, a sort of consensus view that, you know, The impetus of this whole revision of the rules of procedure was about the council being a manager of the process versus actually vetting or looking to produce the outcome of any particular policy process. So as a manager, you know, does that sort of change the conflict issue? And then that dovetails into, you know, are the council reps supposed to be representing the group's interests of their stakeholder group versus their own interests, and we talked about that for quite a bit with Steve and Christina. They seem to understand that position as well, and then we talked about the issue that some stakeholder groups, the registry constituency is one, I think the ISP constituency stakeholder group is another, where actually in the charters it says that the council reps are to be representing the group interests versus their own interests. But then, you know, we discovered that not all stakeholder groups have that same kind of thing baked in, if you will, to their respective stakeholder group charters. So these are all the things we were floating around. Sort of a consensus view of our work team is, well, the conflict really doesn't sit at the council level. The conflict really sits at the stakeholder group level. So how can we resolve? What tools can we look at to implement in what we're looking to do to enable a stakeholder group to resolve the conflict at that level versus it getting into the council level? So that's kind of I just want to give a quick overview of where we're at. Why? Because I just sent out something that Ken Bauer sent. Hopefully you all have it. Anyway, and I'll do a quick summary of what it's saying. And I think it's really accurate, and it was crossing my mind. As we were talking about potential options, if you will, of resolving at the stakeholder group level, we talked about, well, how about if we resolve the conflict by allowing the rep that has the conflict at the stakeholder group level to move their vote to somebody else who representing the stakeholder group who doesn't have such a conflict, or otherwise transfer the vote. And I think what Ken has come back with here is that, well, it's sort of a veiled proxy thing. doing that is while it makes some common sense, you're really going down the path of a proxy vote. And whether fortunately or unfortunately, however you want to look at it, ICANN staff legal has thoroughly looked at this concept of proxy voting in the past and has pretty much landed that we don't want to go there as an organization. ICANN as an organization does not want the GNSO to go there.
Right.
but I'm now going to defer to Ken. Ken, who's typing it. Go ahead now. Now, if you could summarize yourself, please. Go ahead.
I was under the exact same impression that you were, based on just picking up comments here and there that people have made. Well, after talking with Liz Gaster, she said, you should see if you can go into the archives and do some research on this, because we did thoroughly discuss all this back in the 2007 timeframe. So I did that. I went on ICANN's site and did a bunch of searches and stuff, and I found, I think, the sort of seminal document that everybody refers to. It was done by Liz and Dan Haller in combination. The two of them are the authors. And they went through a whole bunch of series of questions and issues related to proxy voting in particular. Now, there is nothing in my mind, after reading it many, many times, that actually tries to disabuse the GNSO of this approach. But what they do is they laid out certain sort of ground rules or criteria that need to be met if you're going to do proxy voting. Now, keep in mind, in 2007, the ICANN bylaws did not – there was a clause in the bylaws that was interpreted to make – that would make proxy voting inconsistent with the bylaws at that time. And I think that clause was something quite innocuous. It was something like, all counselors need to be able to hear and participate with each other on a teleconference. It was something along those lines. It wasn't any. It wasn't something in another section of the bylaws that says in all of ICANN there shall never be proxy voting. Nothing like that. It was a very innocuous sentence. Now, in this document that Liz and Dan prepared, they just mentioned, if we're going to go down this path, the bylaws will have to be changed. Down toward the end of the document, they said, by the way, here's another alternative to proxy voting that you might want to consider, and that would be absentee voting. Well, the people who were involved back then, Philip Shepard, I think, was leading the work team that was a drafting team, whatever it was called then, that was actually working on this problem. They decided, let's just go with absentee voting. That'll get most of the problem done. The whole issue of conflict of interest, by the way, didn't even really come up. It came up briefly, but it was not the main thrust of this. It had to do with absenteeism. So if somebody was going to be absent, couldn't we proxy their vote to somebody else? Well, why don't we just give them absentee voting, and then we're there, right? So that was the context for all of this. Now, when they made the absentee voting policy change, they changed the bylaws to take out that language that said everybody has to be able to hear and talk to each other on the call, right? Because if you're going to be absent and vote absentee, you don't have to be physically on the call and hear each other. And so that eliminated the one argument that was against proxy voting. So two things happened. I don't believe today we have a bylaw constraint to do proxy voting of any kind, because it was already amended to fix for absentee voting. So now that we're into a whole different reason for doing proxy voting, which is conflict of interest issues, I think we have all of the makings to get this done. All right, the document, the 2007, is basically a whole series of sort of questions and answers. It's like, how would a proxy be addressed when there is a conflict of interest? What happens to the requirement for presence of members? What do you do with quorum calculations? It goes on and on and on. And under each one of those, I have written, where applicable, in red, in a different color, my assessment of how far along this team is in meeting that particular issue. And you'll be happy to know that I don't think there's a single one, a single question, a single topic that we already aren't in compliance with or could easily become in compliance with. Therefore, my overall conclusion is I think proxy voting is back on the table. We have not had a chance to get legal to completely get on board here yet. We've sent all the material to them, but they haven't quite had a chance to respond. So
sure.
So I want to leave open the notion that we could still run into a little bit of a problem here. But after doing all this research, I think any of the issues that legal / staff had back then are now handled properly. And so I think we should be in pretty good shape. I'll stop there.
Okay, this is Avery. Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Okay. I pretty much remember it similar to what you've recounted. It was, yes, there's a whole lot of work that would have to be done before you could do proxy voting. So, you know, let's bag it for now. And I haven't obviously had a chance to read what you wrote. Given the new consideration of proxy voting vis-a-vis conflict of interest, the question I would have when you go back to legal, and perhaps you've already written this one or already asked them, is if I have a conflict of interest and I hand off my vote to someone else, does that actually, and I guess it's a question for those that brought up, does it actually satisfy my conflict of interest or just hide it? And as I can pass off my vote to someone who I know will vote as I wish, and I sort of dealt with my conflict of interest without dealing with it. I'm just wondering if that's any sort of concern, and whether that's been dealt with.
Yeah, fair. I think I understand. Great point. The way that we are couching this, and in fact there was a comment in about conflict of interest in the 2007 document that gets at the point you're raising. Let me just summarize it rather than try to read it to everybody. I think that legal had an issue on a conflict of interest where you, I don't think you individually proxy your vote to somebody. That's not the way we've recommended it, and I don't think that would be acceptable. What they were saying in that document was you have to go back and get a consensus position from your constituency, and then that can be proxied. And that's exactly the way we handled it, right?
Mm-hmm.
They said in the absence of a consensus position, then you wouldn't meet the criteria. And when I read that, I went, that's exactly what we did.
Right.
We're saying, we would say a conflicted counselor would go back to their organization, and that organization would then proxy the vote to another counselor based upon, and this is important, based upon a consensus position. In the absence of a consensus position, I think legal is going to say, can't do it.
Right. So let's file a scenario where they don't get a consensus position. Then they would be at the council level having to abstain, and in that case, we would not be changing the denominator.
No, we would be changing the denominator. If all of the remedy procedures are attempted and none of them work, and the counselor abstains and the abstention is recorded, then we would decrement the denominator.
But I would think that if the stakeholder group is not agreeing in a consensus way, then we're sort of then changing the denominator is going against what their own stakeholder group is beliefs.
This is Avery. Can I bring a question into that particular point?
Yes.
I think the thing is not necessarily that, in others, we have some stakeholder groups that basically enforce a consensus party discipline position. We have some, for example, you know, NCSG is one where we'll talk about it. They'll try to reach consensus, but there is no mandating of consensus position on the votes. In other words, when it comes right down to voting, they vote based upon what they think they understand is in the best interest of the stakeholder group, but they make that decision themselves. There's no, you know, stakeholder group-wide or executive committee or something that tells them. It's they are elected to represent the interests of the stakeholder group as best they understand it, and if we don't think they're doing it well, then we don't elect them again.
But basically, the vote is theirs to do the stakeholders' best interest. And so in that case, there would be no stakeholder group consensus because it's not the way the stakeholder group works. And
this is Ken. I have a different view.
Okay, yeah, I'm just trying to say it's not because we couldn't reach one, it's because we don't do it that way.
Right. I got a comment to that, by the way. Ken, you go first.
Okay, sorry. I don't think it makes any difference whether stakeholder groups and or constituencies in particular have any clauses or any requirements or any constraints on their councils as to what they should do in their voting. I think it's irrelevant, and let me say why. I think that what happens is when somebody comes up and says, I have a conflict and I cannot vote, I'm going back to my organization and asking them to develop a position, a consensus position, so that I can be relieved. Even though I may never ask for it and I may never be constrained in my voting or even asked to represent anything particular, in this particular case, I am asking for relief, and therefore the constituency would put some process, I'm sure they have them, where they would go out and ask for points of view, and they would try to develop a consensus to relieve me. If they cannot do it, then I have to abstain. If they can do it, then they would proxy the vote to somebody else, and I would be relieved. So I don't think we have to constrain the constituencies and the stakeholder groups to put in charter provisions or any such thing. All we have to do is ask them, if you were asked, could you do it?
Okay. Yeah, I hear my comment to that, Aubrey's, and yours there is, you know, we definitely want to put the obligation where it belongs, in my view, and somebody could suggest otherwise, but the obligation is upon that stakeholder group to resolve this conflict. And if they choose not to resolve the conflict, let's say like what your example right you just said, Ken, the councilor goes rep goes back to the group and says, I need a consensus position on this, how should I vote? And then the stakeholder group doesn't act, doesn't take on the obligation, then I don't think that's justified at the council level for the denominator to be changed in that example. Others have any thoughts on that? It's like the stakeholder group didn't take on their obligation, and so you can't affect the vote at the council level. Okay,
I have a comment, but I don't want to hog the mic here.
Is anybody else? Ken, cheers.
Okay. I think you have to start with the premise that in the absence of a consensus position, the proxy won't be allowed. I think that's going to be legal's point of view on this based on what I read in the 2007 document. And so in what we said, by the way, in the way we couched our procedures is you start with a conflicted person, that you try to you go through N steps to try to remedy it, whatever those N steps are.
Right.
If you are unable and everybody does what they're supposed to do and tries and they can't do it, that abstention then decrements. That's our flow-through logic procedure. Try A, try B. As long as they're tried and they fail, then you end up with an abstention and you decrement the denominator. If you say, hey, if you try and you fail and you try and you fail, we're still not going to decrement the denominator, then we don't end up taking into account what Steve and Christina were saying.
Okay.
Okay,
so then how do you verify whether they tried?
I'll defer that question.
Yeah, this is Aubrey. Can I?
Yeah.
Even though I'm the second hog at the microphone, so that's why I'm being somewhat reticent. I know, strange notion, me being reticent. But still, I actually think that Ken's reasoning works. Mm-hmm. I think that I think we have to take a stakeholder group's declaration that it went through a process and it tried. I know I very often, when I was in the chair, saw various constituencies try to reach consensus on something, but the constituency was split. And it was split, and there's nothing that they could do about it. And I think even in a constituency like the NCSG that's not taking a party discipline notion to voting, certainly could say, yes, in this case, we need to find out if there is a consensus opinion, and if there is a consensus opinion, then we can do a proxy and to try and develop that. And I think that that's reasonable, and Ken is right, doesn't require adopting a stakeholder group-wide notion of party discipline on votes. So it actually seems to work. I think the trusting stakeholder groups to be doing what they're supposed to be doing is just, you know, you have to trust them.
Yeah,
you know, and by and large, they are going to be trustworthy.
Yeah,
about following internal processes.
Yeah, I'm just drawing out the point that what we're saying here is an honor system to change the denominator, and that changing the denominator is really an important thing, crucial, you know, in those instances when it happens, because it really affects a lot of things. It affects the outcome in a material way. So, and I'm not necessarily against it. I'm just drawing out the point that we're going to rely on the honor system on something, on a very material aspect.
This is Ken.
I'll wait
till Aubrey.
Aubrey, go ahead.
The only thing, as I was going to say, is aren't stakeholder groups and constituencies supposed to be somewhat transparent? So it's not an honor system in a world that's totally opaque. It's an honor system in which not only are we peering over each other's shoulders, but, you know, we have an immense number of staff people that are peering over our shoulders. We're constantly talking. We have 6 counselors. I mean, the idea that you could get a conspiracy of silence going in any of the stakeholder groups or constituencies that would hold for very long is hard to believe to me.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fair. Very fair. Ken?
I wanted to make essentially a similar point. In the procedures, we are talking about documenting everything. The conflicted counselor writes to the constituency, writes to the GNSO secretariat, right? We ask for written responses back from the constituency, right, and or stakeholder group. So I think there's mechanisms. By the way, some of those weren't there in the version you saw, but they're in the new version because one of the things that I found in the 2007 document was this need for transparency. So Aubrey's right on there. The second thing I wanted to say is that we're talking about a very fairly, I hope, rare circumstance. We've already said that a regular abstention that is not related to a material conflict of interest would not change the denominator. So we're narrowing down the abstentions to just those that are material conflicts of interest. That's got to be a pretty rare circumstance.
Well,
and
I don't want to cut you off there, but wasn't Steve and Christina's point that that's not a path we should maybe be going down, trying to distinguish between what is material and what isn't?
I think they were concerned about what we were going to call reasonable attempts at the way we've written it, and the way that in my research on this material, what almost everybody says, I think even the ICANN Board of Directors COI procedures say this too, that there has to be some kind of like financial or
okay, yeah. Here's where I think we landed. I think we landed on it. It's okay to describe examples of what the conflict just can be. I just think they had an issue with what is material and what isn't. Just using the term, almost semantics, using the terms.
Right. And maybe what happens is, in the final analysis, the counselor gets the final say as to whether it's material or not.
Yeah.
We do everything we can to narrow down the bucket, right, the list of things that would qualify for materiality. But in the end, the counselor can say, I have a material conflict of interest. I need to make an abstention, and so I'm declaring this to the people that be. Now we execute the procedures in the GNSO operating procedure. We execute those steps. We go through the remedies, and if, in fact, either the constituency can direct or proxy things, then we don't change any denominators, and the vote happens, and we're good to go. And if all those procedures fail, then we decrement the denominator because the counselor said it was material.
Mm-hmm. Ron Wolf, Any thoughts on all this discussion?
Yes, Wolf speaking.
Yes, Wolf.
I just think so. We came back to the essential things. I mean, so the question of what is a materialized conflict of interest. So, and I would like to refer again to what I have said sometimes. So, and I guess also Ken, I heard Ken saying so. This kind of conflicts may arise very rarely. That means so. Isn't that possible that we that we could think about, you know, what kind of cases could arise? So from your, for example, Ari is very familiar with that from her engagement. You are more than I am. So is there something which she could lay down here? Some points, well, which from our experience may come up in such circumstances on council level, which could end up in a conflict or could be a conflict of interest. So, and saying this, and then we have some more material points, let me say, well, to discuss. Then that would be the one thing. The second thing is what I hear is still open is then, okay, if that is a materialized conflict of interest, does this lead to a to be returned to the constituency or stakeholder group level to solve this conflict, let's say, and come up with kind of proxy voting or come up with a kind of direction from this stakeholder group how to vote. You could just add. So I would not refer to the constituency because the constituency may have the same problem. A conflict of interest. Let me say, if there's a conflict from the registrar point of view, because somebody of the council representative of the registrar has some conflict regarding his registrar engagement, so the registrar constituency would have the same conflict, I guess. So we have to go back to at least to the stakeholder group level. I have no solution to that, but I would like to find out what kind of cases could arise and could be write that those down, and maybe in the future. So we should keep that kind of list of issues, list of conflicts of interest, keep it open, and add something in case something arises new.
Yeah, I think that's a great suggestion. So Ken has a sort of a short list now of examples, right, of financial interest, et cetera, some things.
Yes,
but
in section 4 of the procedures.
Yeah. So then in the future, as we should have a way to document other instances of a conflict of interest that we perhaps didn't think of, and then can be added to the list. Is that what you're suggesting, Wolf?
Yes.
Yeah, that's a good suggestion. So we can offer some examples up front, but then in actual practice, we may learn, you know, from experience, there are others.
Mm-hmm.
And so somehow documenting and who documents that, you know, would be a good suggestion from us.
Yeah.
Ron, do you have anything?
Okay. No, I'm just taking it all in. I don't have anything to add to this discussion at this stage. Thanks, Chair.
Okay.
May I jump in? This is Ken.
Yes, Ken, please.
Just a couple things. Yeah, I wanted to highlight that Section 4 of the current procedures, there's a whole section in which we discuss material conflict of interest. We asked 5 questions to a potentially conflicted counselor that would be sort of semi-helpful in terms of what it says is the following questions may provide guidance in determining whether an MCOI actually exists. You have an economic interest in the result. Is your economic interest directly involved? And so forth and so on. And then following that, there are actually 1, 2, 3. There are actually 5, you know, examples. They're not examples that directly relate to the GNSO, but they're examples I picked up from other places on the Internet where they say these are situations that would typically give rise to a material conflict of interest. So if we could take some time down the road or maybe ask some people in the larger community to flesh out some real cases that might fit in this model, we could add them into this particular section.
And by the way, in the email that I forwarded earlier to the list, I'm looking at the five numeral five things that Ken had in there plus the 5 points. I'm looking at a document that's called GNSO Ops Procedures COI Proxy Voting Revised Red Line.
Yes.
And that's the attachment that was on the email, if you guys want to follow along on that.
Yeah.
Those are the areas.
My second point. I promise I'll be quiet. The second point Wolf raised that I disagree with, I'm afraid to say, is that we should raise everything to the stakeholder group. I remember very vividly Steve Metallet saying, look, you guys keep saying stakeholder group, but you got to understand, in my stakeholder group, the commercial, we don't have any kind of procedures to deal with this sort of a thing at that level. And that's when I said, if we say constituency and or stakeholder group and we drop it down to the lowest level where there are such procedures, then that issue went away. So I would suggest that we continue with the language constituency and or stakeholder group so that that covers us to deal with the organization's maturity level.
Yeah. I agree, yeah.
May I just briefly answer to that, why I'm of this opinion, so Ken, because, we have in the different two houses, we have different kind of levels. So in the contracted house, we have constituency equals stakeholder group. So that means, so registrar constituency is the registrar stakeholder group. There is no difference. In the other house, we have differences in that. So at the time being, Steve Metallis is right. We do not have any procedure. We do not have any fixed charter at the time being about stakeholder group, the commercial stakeholder group, because it's still under discussion. So I'm open to put something into that, which is related to the abstention as well. But at the time being, and maybe also for some time more, so we don't have that. That's correct.
Yeah. Hi, this is Avery. I have two things. One, I think subsidiarity works in terms of if the proper level to do it in a particular stakeholder group is constituency, then yes, that's where it should happen. If the proper place to do it is stakeholder group, it should happen at the appropriate, layer that can make that kind of call. So I think, what Ken is saying, constituency and or stakeholder group, again, allowing that most of these groups are doing their best to do the right thing and they'll figure out what the right level for them to do it is. The other thing I wanted to bring in, and I'm not sure. Now, I abstained for many reasons many times, and most of those weren't material. However, I did occasionally have one that I don't think was economic interest, even though there was an economic link. And so let me bring it up. As was well known, I do a lot of contracting for the UN. A couple decisions were made that concerned decisions that related to some part of the UN system. There was a whole appeal at some point by international organizations for certain changes. At that point, even though there wasn't an economic, the UN's not going to make more money or less money, and I'm not going to get fired or not fired from my contract because of this decision. It's a non-profit making thing, so there isn't a financial interest in it. Yet it was still very concretely a conflict of interest for me to vote on something that would have a serious political effect or some, maybe that's not the right word, on the organization for which I was contracting. And so, and I think we may have to look a little wider for those who are employed or involved with non-commercial organizations to pinpoint what materiality actually means when financial is not the driving force.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, these 5 points that are in here are all the examples, which are all good ones. The questions are all economic, related around economic. And we all know there's different motivations and purposes and what drives people to lobby things in this world outside of ICANN, including not always just economic interest. Sometimes it's you vote for this now and I'll vote for that later. You know, there's all kinds of things that go on. I don't know the answer to that offhand. You know, it kind of drives to what is a material conflict of interest as it relates to the GNSO. That's why I go back to being a manager of the process. So it's almost like in managing the process, does your conflict, you know, because you're not deciding. The idea of the counselors is not to decide or vet or, you know, produce the outcome. It's simply to manage it. So in your role in managing the process, do you have an economic interest in the results? You know, something. So it's almost like qualifying it every time in your role of managing. Does that help any?
It does. This is Avery again, but the question is still is, does this have a significant effect on your organization? And the effect is, yes, often financial in the situations that the GNSO deals with, but not always. And that's where I'm sort of at a quandary, because I know it's a fuzzy border to say, you know, when I'm working for the UN, if anything has an effect on the UN, to what extent am I bound?
Can any of these questions that we're talking about here be addressed in the declaration of interest and statements of interest forms? Can it be addressed there?
Well, certainly when I filled one of those out, I would always say, you know, I'm a contractor for the UN, and lately I've added that if anything, any decision reflects on any government that's a member of the UN, I have to sort of stay out of it. And you know, as a sort of international civil servant almost.
Okay, so let's run with that example, though, for a minute. So then we have these five steps that you have to, whatever these steps are, right, Ken?
Mm-hmm.
We have these end steps that, you think you have a conflict, so there's these end steps that you go through. If the stakeholder group does not, or constituency does not, is not unable to provide a consensus view on whatever that is, then this would be a situation where the you could abstain at the council level and the denominator would be changed.
As long as it wasn't restricted just to financial issues, yes.
Yeah, and this is Ken. I think Aubrey makes a great point. And I thought I had tried to do that, to say, financial or otherwise. And I think we just need to go back and in some of the language in the current version, I say advantage financially or economically. Maybe we should add or
political.
Politically, yeah, that might be another good way to do it. But I just think there's some. We could make some wordsmith changes to make it just a little bit broader than only financial and economic. Although that is the typical one that most organizations worry about, because what they're worried mostly about, Avery, is that you personally or a family member of yours materially benefits from a decision you're making in another context. Not so much that the organization that you're consulting gets some benefit out of it. I think that's a lesser concern.
Okay.
Well, that's the second one. Sorry, okay.
No, go ahead.
That's a second-order concern. If I think I can get myself a better role at the UN by making sure they get X, you know, it's still, you know, it's not economic interest that I'm talking about. You know, it's more power.
That's a fair point.
All right, so we're getting a little granular. Taking a step back and a little bit higher level, how do we feel as a work team that comfortable that by putting this document, and I know you haven't all read, had a chance to read through it thoroughly. I know I haven't, to be honest with you, but I'm able to look at it now, and I'm reading through it. How comfortable are we that by implementing this into the rules of procedure, that we have a high confidence level that the situation of changing the denominator at the council level will be rare, be the exception? That's what I'm trying to get a handle on that now. It's like, because I think you're intending, Ken, as a suggestion, to put this and some wordsmithing now, still some wordsmithing to do, but putting this into the rules of procedure, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so if we assume that they're in the rules of procedure, how comfortable are we as a work team that the instance of an abstention at the council level resulting in a change of the denominator will most likely be very rare? Anybody have any thoughts on that? Ken, I think you feel it'll be rare, right?
I think another way to phrase the question might be, does anybody recall, or I guess Glenn's not on the call, but does anyone recall anyone ever having abstained due to a conflict of interest? Even if it wasn't material, just any conflict of interest.
I think Aubrey just said
people have.
Okay. And this is Ron. I think that the reality is that with the stronger SOI-DOI wording that we have, I think it's going to be more often, only from the point of view that the chair is now going to say, does anyone have a change in the declaration of interest before the meeting starts or before they discuss a specific topic? So from that point of view, I think that we're going to be seeing more of it. I don't know if it'll be a lot or a little, but I do believe that with these new changes in place and the rules of procedure, we'll see more of it.
Then this is Ken, if I may. Then I would change the question. I'll fix it so that maybe the way to say it is, how frequently do we think, in the case of a conflict of interest, that a constituency or, if appropriate, stakeholder group would be able to remedy it by developing a consensus position and then proxying it?
Yeah, that's
exactly. I think mostly they could do it.
Would constituencies and stakeholder groups be more interested in making sure that their vote counts versus being decremented and removed, and therefore try to get this thing solved? I mean, if we had the answer to that, then we would probably know how rare it would be that we'll change the denominator.
This is Aubrey speaking. From what I've seen, both from watching constituencies for 5 years and from being in one for 5 weeks, or maybe a little longer, they prefer to have their vote. The mechanics of, God, if I abstain, then we only need 6 instead of 7, mechanics is much more difficult. It takes someone far more into political scheming to use that mechanism to gain an advantage. Mostly it's just, we got 6 votes, I want to use all 6 of our votes, you know, let's figure this out, I think is much more the driving goal than, you know, real political backroom maneuvering to change the denominator.
Mm-hmm. That's fair.
Also, this is Ken, keep in mind that because the two houses have odd numbers, 7 and 13, one COI or one abstention due to that doesn't change the requirement in many cases, in most cases actually, due to the thresholds. I sort of went through all the thresholds and said, what happens if we went from 7 to 6, 13 to 12? And because of the way that... yeah, certainly majority it doesn't change, right? I think it might in a 75% case, but in many thresholds, just one of those itself, even if you decrement the denominator, the requirement to produce yes votes doesn't change.
Okay. That's good to know.
Yeah.
Well, I feel that if these procedures that we add, and if we're hearing now, which, again, we're hearing now that proxy voting may not be the taboo or off-limits thing for us to go down, if that's true, and we still need to hear a little bit from legal, and if we're feeling comfortable that the procedures that we can incorporate into the rules of procedure to to enable it is going to be the rare exception of a change in the denominator. I'm for, you know, offering that kind of tool and answering sort of Christina and Steve's long-standing issue. How do others feel? Aubrey, are you okay?
No, I wasn't going to jump in first. I seem to have argued in favor of it enough that it's probably almost obvious that, yeah,
All right. Why not? That's the way I feel. Wolf, any reason not to? I think Ron might have jumped off.
No.
All right. Well, then, with that said, I'm kind of in favor of having Ken, if you don't mind, continuing as you're going along here, which is phenomenal work, by the way, that we really appreciate. I mean, just outstanding. I can't say it enough. If you can continue on with the wordsmithing, and we continue, and maybe this is now the tool that you bring back to legal, and of course talking with Liz as well, and see if they have any pushback on this thing.
Ray, Ken here. Happy to continue to do it. Yes, I'll make a few more tweaks. The document that actually says revised redline, and I apologize for the complexity in the wording, but I wanted to differentiate this from the one that already had redline changes that was already on the list that we really never cleaned up. So I had to clean that one up in order to make another set of changes to give to legal that really fixed the 2007 issues. So, if you follow all that. But, yes, I will I'll make a few more changes to try to broaden that materiality thing as we discussed today. I think politically is actually a pretty good one. And so legal already has all the current material. I don't think they need to see another version just yet, but they might have a few other things to suggest to our text, and I'll put all that in and try to get all that done before our next session. So I think we'll have what we really need to focus on in terms of recommending something to go into the rule procedures.
Okay, I think that's a good game plan, and then from there, in our next call. Let's take a consensus view of whether we want to send that document then over to the OSC for their review and our suggestion to incorporate it into the rules of procedure. Does that sound like an action plan?
Yeah.
Okay, now I just want to point out the 30th, our next call, if we stay on the 2 weeks, depends on how do we want as a group look at this. Today is the 16th. We were actually supposed to have a call last week on the 9th, and we missed it, thanks to me. Do we want to continue now 2 weeks from today? I think that's what we're saying. That would put us at the 30th. Now, the 30th...
How does that fit with Ken taking a vacation during the holidays and doing all this work?
Fear not. I'm a paid consultant. I work all the time.
that's what I always say it too. As paid consultants, we don't take holidays. That's called unemployment.
That's right.
You don't have a conflict of interest here, do you, Ken?
No, I don't.
All right, just make sure.
You know, one of the things that we might also do in the interim is to do see if we can't collect up maybe 3 or 4 or 5. Not too many more examples, and the one that Aubrey articulated might be a great one to put into the procedures, right? So we have here's some questions that you might ask, here are some examples that might lead, and here are some real GNSO cases that might help with a decision of that kind. Is that a good idea?
Yeah, I think it is, and maybe this is a good time to add that. The chair of the OSC, Chuck Gomes, had a suggestion on, because I have to submit updates of where we're at and what we're doing, and so obviously I updated him that we're on this subject and here's where we're at and what we're talking about. And Chuck had a suggestion that we could also reach out to the constituency and stakeholder group work team chaired by Olga. Why? Because I don't think it's in our mandate, and others can disagree, but I don't think it's in our mandate or scope to start at the rules of procedures level, say, and influence what individual stakeholder group or constituency charters are to say, right? Because if all of the stakeholder groups had the language that the registry constituency has or the ISP and a couple others, we probably wouldn't even be having this discussion, because in those charters, it's clear that the reps are to be representing the group at all times, and they know that when they take the position, and therefore the conflicts of interest just don't exist. And so example, say, and I'll just stay with Chuck for a minute. Chuck is obviously the chair of the council now, but he's also the registry constituency council rep. VeriSign is his employer. He knows that whatever actions he takes at the council level now can't have a conflict with his employer. You know, it's just not allowed, or don't take the job.
Ray, this is Ken. I'd like to jump in here, though, and I think we've been down this path, and I thought we had decided that that's whether or not the constituency or stakeholder group allows you freedom in your voting doesn't change the conflict problem. This is Christina's main point. I have a professional conflict. If somebody tells me, go vote like this, even if they write it down, go vote like this, my conflict is still real and it's still there, and I could be, my firm could be sued if I vote. So I think what we should do in our case, differentiate. We should put a hard line between.
Yeah.
We're not making any requirements on constituencies or stakeholder groups, and we're not asking anybody to change any charters. All we're going to say in the GNSO procedures is, if you, counselor, have a conflict, we are asking you to go back to your constituencies and see if they can do a proxy. Now, at that point...
No, I'm not disagreeing. I'm not trying to rehash. I'm not disagreeing with that. I don't want to take this work team down the path of the charge. That's what I'm trying to say in a long-winded way. The suggestion from Chuck was, should the constituency and stakeholder group do that? Is that he seems to feel that that could be within their scope to examine and look at this particular issue. And my question was only, you know, I don't want to go back to Chuck and say, yeah, that sounds a great idea.
This is Avery. Can I add something?
Yeah, all right. Sure. Allow Avery, for sure.
Yeah, go
ahead,
Avery.
One of the things that I'm not sure that particular question is in their scope, but certainly looking at procedures for how a constituency or stakeholder group would do the right thing to be able to come to a consensus position for a vote, whether they've got party discipline or not, does seem like something that would be worth sending off to their groups, you know, to basically give advice on, you know, if you don't normally go for consensus positions to mandate your do you need a process or procedure to do that to meet this proxy condition?
Okay.
So, in other words, we're certainly not mandating a change in charters
or
internal processes, but it may be a useful tool, a useful problem for them to consider how, you know, in a constituency or a stakeholder group without voting discipline, this gets managed. This can happen.
Okay.
This is Ken?
Yeah, Ken.
The other thing, it would be timing. If we do decide to take something to the constituency ops team, I would recommend that we at least wait until we've gone through, at least after our next meeting, because even though I'm feeling more confident, I'm not 100% sure yet where we are with legal on this. So once we get to that point and we say, you know what, we've got everything we need to go, maybe that would be a good time to share the procedure with the constituency and stakeholder group team and say, you know, here's where we're going with this. Do you guys have any thoughts as to what your work is with respect to constituencies and stakeholder groups and how this might apply to your stuff? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I think what I'm hearing is, no, let's not go back to Chuck as the chair of the OSC and say, yeah, we would like this other work team to look at the issue of mandating whatever in a charter. But let's wait until we get this part more baked and then go back to them and say, now here's areas of what we're implementing in the rules of procedure that we think that work team can put some procedure to. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, if nothing else, for example, the stakeholder groups' charters and constituency charters, they might want to put something in that says, if we are asked by a counselor of ours, under the auspices of the GNSO procedures, which now say this can be done, we want to put something in our charter that says we will do proxy voting. In other words, we will execute that procedure as allowed by the council.
Okay.
Yeah, and that might be
might
be the linkage.
Thank you, Ken. That's what I was trying to burble out.
Okay, good. All right. I think that's a great plan of action. So where are we? So the 30th, we'll target for now the 30th. Obviously, we're coming running into the holidays, and we're not going to hold legal or anybody else to anything. But we'll plan on the 30th, perhaps having a document maybe even a day before to look at and decide on the 30th whether we want to send that over to the OSC with the recommendation that it gets put into the rules of procedure. Is that where we're at?
I believe so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, here's a request I have of Julie. You still on the phone, Julie?
I sure am, and I've just noted that those action items, and I'll be sure to put them up on our wiki.
Here's another one. You know, we've spent so much time on the rules of procedure for really months now. You know, where do we head next? You know, it's almost like we're at a point of reprioritizing our work. There's a lot of work to be done. There were a lot of things that came out of the Board Governance Committee for this particular work team to look at, et cetera. Obviously, that was quite a while ago, and maybe things have changed. But, you know, now it's time to reprioritize our work, and I'm looking for suggestions of how we go about that.
Well, Ray, this is Julie. So I do have one thought. As you know, the Statement of Interest, Declaration of Interest policy or procedure, whatever you want to call it, that this group had devised, you know, went to ICANN legal staff. ICANN legal provided comments to it, and that was sent around to the team some time ago, but of course we were tied up in on the procedures.
Yeah.
There are now, I think, perhaps some related issues that have come out of the discussion on abstentions. Perhaps the next step might be to look at that document and the changes suggested by legal and take that discussion.
Okay, so double back to the SOI DOI based on the comments that we asked for comments, we got them, we never addressed those comments, so a next action item would be to start to look at that. Could you resend that around to the list?
Absolutely. I'll do that.
Doesn't have to be today.
That's all right. I can send it today. It's ready to go. It's
okay. All right, so then beyond that, also, you know, we need to discuss, I think, as a work team, where we want to head next. And if there's nothing else, I don't have anything else. Anybody have anything else?
No.
If not, let's go ahead and adjourn the call and the recording. Well, end the recording first. First, I'll say happy holidays to everybody.
Yeah, same to you.
Happy holidays.
Thank you.
Sure, and we'll end the call, and I just want to say thanks again to all the effort, and Ken especially. Really, really nice work. Really impressive.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye, y'all.
Okay,
bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for attending today's conference. This call has concluded. You may disconnect at this time.